Topi Chana Bahala Bhagavare Hare Topi Chana Bahala Bhagavare Hare Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tira Vanaka Hare Yamuna Tira
Vishnupad, Paramahamsa Pad, Raja Kachara, Sri Sri Shimon, Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada, Kijai, Iskan Founder Charya, Srila Prabhupada, Kijai, Samaveda Bhakti Vrinda, Kijai, Gaura Premananda, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to Sri Guru and Sri Gauranga. Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Gosvami Kripale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Phenomena Namaste Saraswati Gaura Bhanga Swami Shishamara Vasti Namaste. So we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 13, Dhritarashtra quits home. Is it text 22? I hope. Andak Puraiva Vadhiro Manda Pragyascha Sampratam Vishirna Danto Mandhagni Saraga Kapam Udhavan Andak Puraiva Vadhiro Manda Pragyascha Sampratam Vishirna Danto Mandagni Saraga Kapam Puthahan Andak Puraiva Vahiro Manda Pragyascha Sampratam Vishirno Danto Mandhagni Saraga Kapam Udhvahan
Thank you.
Ananda. Blind. Pura. From the beginning. Eva. Certainly. Vadhira. Hard of hearing. Manda Pragya. Memory shortened. Cha. And. Sampratam. Recently. Vishirna. Loosen. Dantak. Teeth. Manda Agni. Liver action decreased. Saraja. The sound. Kapam. Coughing much mucus. Udvahan. Coming out. Translation purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. You have been blind from your very birth, and recently you have become hard of hearing. Your memory is shortened, and your intelligence is disturbed. Your teeth are loose, your liver is defective, and you are coughing up mucus. I'll note that we have two gerontologists, MDs, in the room. Would you agree these are symptoms of old age? Okay. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The symptoms of old age, which have already developed in Dhritarashtra, were all one after another pointed out to him as warning that death was nearing very quickly. And still, he was foolishly carefree about his future. The signs pointed out by Vidura in the body of Dhritarashtra were signs of apakshaya, or dwindling of the material body before the last stroke of death. The body is born, it develops, stays, creates other bodies, dwindles, and then vanishes. But foolish men want to make a permanent settlement of the perishable body and think that their estate, children, society, country, etc., will give them protection. With such foolish ideas, they become overtaken by such temporary engagements and forget altogether they must give up this temporary body and take a new one, again to arrange for another term of society, friendship, and love. Again, to perish ultimately. They forget their permanent identity and become foolishly active for impermanent occupations, forgetting altogether their prime duty. Saints and sages like the Dura approach such foolish men to awaken them to the real situation, but they take such sadhus and saints as parasites of society, and almost all of them refuse to hear the words of such sadhus and saints. Although they welcome show-bottle sadhus and so-called saints who can satisfy their senses. Vidura was not a sadhu to satisfy the ill-gotten sentiment of Dhritarashtra. He was correctly pointing out the real situation of life and how one could be saved, how one could save oneself from such catastrophes. Translation again. You have been blind from your very birth, and recently you become hard of hearing. Your memory is shortened and your intelligence is disturbed. Your teeth are loose, your liver is defective, and you are coughing up mucus. Om Jnana Tamrandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chatsavim Kamina Tasmai Shri Kirti Maha Vanchakopa Thirvishya Kripa Sindhu Bevacha Patjano Pavani Do Vaishnavevi Unamona Maha. A couple weeks ago, the last time I gave Bhagavatam class, it's interesting because the verse there was the one where Vidura is talking to Yudhishthira, and he doesn't want to disturb Yudhishthira's mind by telling him about the annihilation of the Yadu dynasty because it would not have been beneficial for him, and he did not want to unnecessarily convey unpleasant things. And I think I mentioned at the time that we'll see a contrast between his unwillingness to disturb Yudhishthira with unpleasant things, and here speaking so strongly to Dhritarashtra to deliberately disturb him. His goal is to disturb Dhritarashtra, to arouse him from material complacency. Dhritarashtra was in a terrible position of life, basically just living out his life. We'll see tomorrow even a stronger description of the sort of embarrassment that he was undergoing, living off the charity of his enemies who he tried to kill. So here he is, and his whole body is failing. He is entering this last stage of life. And so Vidura speaks strongly to him. And Srila Prabhupada points out at the end of this purport that this is the real purpose of saintly persons, not to insult people or frighten people, or certainly not to necessarily be unpleasant, but to speak the truth for their benefit. And we see how Prabhupada did that. Prabhupada would speak very kindly most of the time. He would be very encouraging to people, and when necessary, he would speak strongly to sort of shake people out of their lethargy or their apathy, or to get them to understand the purpose of life. I was just thinking about, if you listen to Prabhupada's old lectures from 66, 67, so many times he always ends a lecture, it seems like, not always, but so often with, please, please use this human form of life. Please take this. He's begging, entreating people. Please take to Krishna consciousness to benefit them. And so in the same way, Vidura is speaking for the benefit of Dhritarashtra, speaking strong truth to say, what are you doing here? You've got to get out and take up spiritual life. Now, specifically in this verse, Vidura is speaking about the stage of dwindling, the loss of capacity in old age. So Prabhupada says this stage is called apakshaya, or dwindling. Some of us can relate to that. Let's see, memory check, hearing check, check, check. My liver's not too bad. No. But we get the point. Basically, at the end of life, everything starts to go. You know, we know, Chris, another way, there's all these, different stages. There's birth, death, disease, and old age. We know disease, old age, that's at the end. And, of course, leads to death. Here we have the six stages mentioned, or one of the stages, where the human body goes through different stages and aspects from birth to death. Now, this was very interesting because when I was a professor, one of the classes, one of the things I studied and taught was human development. I was very interested in that. And in human development, they love stage theories. Right? Some of you have taken some of these courses probably in education or something. Eric Erickson had his psychosocial developmental stages. Piaget had his cognitive stages. You all remember those, right? Pre-operational and all that, formal operational. Anyway, there's actually many more. There's a stage for everything in development. Somebody's thought of it, come up with ways. This is all based upon how the body develops through the lifespan of birth to death, And it's just looking at different aspects of it, the different aspects of our mind, of our body, of our, this. So the Srimad Bhagavatam gives us a very simple theory of human development. It says the body is born, it develops, it stays, it creates other bodies, it dwindles, and then vanishes. That's it. That's what we need to know about the body. Not such a good thing. Now, it's interesting that if you propose this to a very hardcore material scientist, or atheistic scientist at least, I should say, he'd probably agree. Yeah, that's what goes on. Body goes through these stages. We all see it. You can see everybody going through it without fail. And so this would be a very similar idea. And because they often think that what happens to the body is basically just biochemical change and more complex experiences like cognition, emotion, thoughts, hopes, dreams, all these things are really attributed to brain chemistry for the most part. I was once in one class, I was looking at definitions of love because love is very important to us. This is Bhakti Yoga. But what do materialists and others think about it and how they define it? And from the scientific point of view, love is simply a matter of the arousal of things that create endorphins, senses of pleasure in the brain. And therefore, you feel that you're attracted to something that's all chemical. There is some truth to that, because that does go on the bodily platform. But that is not all we look at. If we only see that, we'll end up like Dhritarashtra, stuck in material consciousness and material plane. And whenever I give a class, I try to find the key point that Prabhupada makes, or a sentence in the purport or something, kind of expand on that. And Prabhupada says in his purport basically that they forget their permanent identity and become foolishly active for impermanent occupations, forgetting altogether their prime duty. So we forget our permanent identity, and we become active in so many things, and we forget what is our prime duty of life. So what is that permanent identity? The spirit soul, of course. It's the spirit soul that impels life, all of these changes, that impels consciousness. Without the presence of the spirit soul, you have an inert, dead body. You simply have matter. You have chemicals. You have elements, material elements. You inject the spirit soul, and you have life. Life comes at life. In fact, these life symptoms, how should I say it? All of these symptoms all are symptoms of the soul. Because the soul is present, we are seeing that manifest in different bodies of different organisms. The lecture that Sri Prabhupada gave on Bhagavad Gita 9:34, he says, wherever there is growth, there are the six symptoms of presentation, as we discussed. He said, these are the presence of the soul. Growth is one of the important ones. So growth, as soon as the soul is out of the body, there is no more growth. So we can find so many instances in the scriptures. It's very clear that none of these processes that the body goes through happen without the soul. When the soul leaves, there's only the last process, death of that particular body. I think I've said this before, but a real interesting little aside here. Interesting example of this was in 1976 when Prabhupada visited Potomac. I was there in Washington, at the Washington Potomac Temple, and there was a darshan I was able to attend where Prabhupada had with a scientist, Sri Damodar, or Brahmachari at the time, Maharaj, and the others were giving a presentation of what they, sort of how they were going to put together what would eventually become the book Life Comes from Life, but I think that wasn't actually done for several years later. But it was like the beginning of their formulating their ideas and their strategy in trying to show, and Prabhupada really encouraged this. He loved what they were doing, you know, to actually show scientifically that there was consciousness, there was life, there was the soul, ultimately there was God. So they're giving a presentation, they're talking about symptoms of life. They say a living thing, you know, will show these six symptoms as they go through it. And they said, you know, like we see in animals and plants like that. And something that doesn't have life, like a rock, you won't see this. And Prabhupada stopped and said, oh? He says, sometimes rocks are alive. It's kind of like, okay, you know, back to the drawing board here. And Prabhupada explained it a little bit. You know, explained, so it's like mountains. You know, mountains, you know, there's geological processes. There's always a material explanation for whatever happens. In other words, something is happening with the matter, but what's impelling it, that's the issue that we're looking at here. So the spirit soul is there, the mountain grows, you know, it appears as byproducts, I don't know, the rocks or something, or I don't know what they are, and eventually it stops. And so it says, so if I pick up a rock, it's a living entity? The Prabhupada says, no, most rocks are dead now. So, you know, he said, it's simple. He says, once it was alive, now it probably usually isn't. It's just like you go into the forest. A tree is alive. It dies. It falls down and you see a dead log. You know, that's the body. Life was there, now it's not there. So in the same way, and they gave the example of crystals, how crystals grow. They actually do. And go through all of the, you know, these different processes. So living entities are everywhere. Life is everywhere, is the point that Prabhupada was making. You know, we, in fact, sometimes even as devotees, we have certain constraints upon what we understand and what we see and what's going on, because we tend to look through the lens of these material eyes and material senses and sometimes miss the greater picture of what's happening all around us, which I'll talk about a little bit more later. So we need to understand the soul is the source of all this growth. Everything happens in the body, no soul, no growth, dead body. And we have to know what is our prime duty. Bhagavatam 2.43, Prabhupada says, absolute path of perfection is accepting transcendental loving service of the Lord as our prime duty. So that's a simple one, at least for those of you in this room and most of you listening as devotees. We know our duty is to serve Krishna. You know, to take up the process of devotional service, loving service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But yet most people have forgotten that. And Dhritarashtra had certainly forgotten that. He had forgotten his prime duty because he had forgotten his permanent identity as spirit, soul, part and parcel of God, in his relationship of love and devotional service. Now, because of that, he needed to be awakened to that. Now, I was thinking about this, and I was considering a couple questions. Can the experience of the body and the senses be considered separate from spiritual experience? Okay, we know there's no life without the presence of the soul. So, can the body just go ahead and kind of do its thing in the material world? Yeah, I know I'm a spirit soul, but, you know, I'm just here existing, and I'm in this body, and so let the body do what it wants to do. Enjoy how it wants to enjoy. I mean, one might think that. And the other thing I was thinking is, if so many people, I mean, many people can understand this, but why are they complacent and forgetful of the relationship with God? Now, materialism, as it's philosophically defined, is exactly the same way the Prabhupada used it. Prabhupada used the term very much correctly from a philosophical perspective. Materialism, basically, in its most simplistic definition, Steve D. Mooney will probably correct me, is the belief that everything is ultimately matter. Everything we see in this phenomenal world, that is what is true. It is material. And that may be the domain of very hardcore scientists. Not all, but many will think that. Only 30 or 40% of scientists in the natural science fields are atheists. They're not all. So I want to be clear on that. But their voice seems to be disproportionately strong. In other words, you know, because when it comes to religion, metaphysics, they say, well, that's not my domain. We're not going to talk about that. We're just going to talk about science, what we experience, what is experiential, through the senses. So at any rate, now, do most people feel that way? Not really. Although, you know, there's very strong propaganda in this direction, most people do not accept there is nothing other than matter. They're very influenced by authorities. Authorities you learn in school when you're children. Did everybody learn the theory of evolution? Mostly, probably, right? I thought it was true. We all thought it was true. Especially what Brahma told us, it wasn't really true. Now we're finding that there's a very, very large percentage of scientists say, well, actually, we don't really believe it's quite true either. There's all kinds of problems with the theory. It's full of holes. I mean, you know, they may not believe exactly that, you know, creation came through, you know, Garbhodakshe Vishnu laying down and all the, in other words, they may not believe the Bhagavatam theory of creation, but they certainly don't all believe in evolution. So it's been largely refuted. Now, but the interesting thing is the great majority of people in the United States do believe in God. I used to say years ago that it was 95%. Well, it is going down a little bit. You know, Kali Yuga is making a little bit of impact. So now it's down to about 89 or 90%, depending upon the polls that you look at. The Gallup polls and the Pew, P-E-W, ones are pretty good. They have very good statistical processes. They're very accurate. They're pretty good. So, and Gallup particularly has tracked all kinds of things with religion throughout the last several decades. So it's kind of interesting. You can really find all these statistics. But the purport, or the takeaway from this, is that most people, at least in the United States, do believe in God, or at least a higher power. Like, I think it's about 80% say they believe in God, and another 10% say, I'm not sure about God, but I do believe there's some higher power or some higher something, you know. And only 2 or 3% actively identify as atheists. So it's a small amount of people who say, I don't believe in God, I'm an atheist. Some will say, I'm not sure, whatever. Now, this is a notable exception. The tendency in Western, industrial, more wealthy countries is away from God. In Europe, you'll see it totally different. You see 50% of the people in France say, I don't really believe in God. America's an exception. It's an outlier on that. Interestingly, where you do see high belief in God is places like India, Bangladesh, the Philippines, places like that, mostly in Asia. And South America to some degree, you know, where there's still strong religious traditions. So, as we took this little detour into the land of statistics, we'll try to bring this back. Why, if there is such strong belief, let's just say in America, in the existence of God, why does it not appear that we're very religious as a society? Why does it appear that we're very materialistic? That there is very little spiritual understanding. And it is true that for many, there's a disconnect between their belief system and their actual activity. What they do, how they live, you know, what is really the core basis of their lives. For many, belief may be there, but it plays very little part in their life. And I would say it's due to two reasons. Probably could come with more, but I just thought of two, kind of, and what we're discussing here. One is complacency, and the second one is impersonalism. Now, I'll explain that. Complacency, this is the situation of Dhritarashtra. Did Dhritarashtra not know Vedic philosophy? Is it possible that if you have relatives like Vidura and Yudhishthira, and you're surrounded by really Bhishma Dev and Mahajan, that you, of course he heard the philosophy, of course he knew it. His whole life.
He heard the
Bhagavad Gita. Sanjaya told him the whole Bhagavad Gita, right? Yeah. Describe it. Dhritarashtra heard Krishna, you know, heard at least relayed by Sanjaya. You're right. So there wasn't a problem with philosophical understanding. It was a problem with complacency. He was just old, defeated. You know, he just got into this funk, you know. And we know Dhritarashtra is a great soul. He eventually gets liberated. You know, he takes up the path, as we'll see as this chapter evolves. But when he was strongly preached to by Vidura, his spiritual life revived. Now, that's the case with many people in the Western world. I think all of us, you know, we were very complacent. Not all of us. Some of us were suffering, were miserable. Some of us were complacent. So many different things. People come to Krishna consciousness, four different kinds of people. But Prabhupada got us out of our complacency. His strong preaching, just like Vidura, he convinced so many people that, no, there is a greater purpose of life. I need to take up spiritual life. This is critical. This is the prime duty of humankind. So a complacency is often there. Our desires for enjoyment, for sense gratification, are often stronger than our spiritual desires. So you see many people compartmentalize religion, right? It's kind of like it's over here on Sunday or Saturday or whatever, you know, whatever day one worships. And then my life just kind of goes on here. So that's what we see, particularly in countries like America, where if you question, you'll be able to say, well, do you believe in God? Yeah. No, not everybody, not all these people go to church or actively practice. That's different. But they do believe. But they become distracted by the material life and waste their time. Now, this is a real theme that the Bhagavatam stresses a lot, right? It tells us. And where more clearly than in Prahlad Maharaj's instructions in these. I'm going to read these. There's like three verses here, 7, 6, 6 through 8. Because this is our dilemma. Prahlad says, every human being has a maximum duration of life of 100 years. But for one who cannot control his senses, half of those years are completely lost because at night he sleeps 12 hours, being covered by ignorance. Therefore, such a person has a lifetime of only 50 years. In the tender age of childhood, when everyone is bewildered, one passes 10 years. Similarly, in boyhood, engaged in sporting and playing, one passes another 10 years. In this way, 20 years are wasted. Similarly, in old age, when one is an invalid, unable to perform even material activities like Dhritarashtra, one passes another 20 years wastefully. One whose mind and senses are uncontrolled becomes increasingly attached to family life because of insatiable lust of desires and strong illusion. In such a madman's life, the remaining years are also wasted because even during those years, he cannot engage himself in devotional service. So there's really no time for devotional service. I mean, really, I don't even know how any of us do it. No time. We even got a lot. No, of course there's time. We make choices. We make priorities. You know, our consciousness, one can be working a job 12 hours a day, but one's consciousness can be thinking of Krishna or trying to chant Hare Krishna or whatever. You know, in other words, Yes, one just won't, most people become so distracted by the everything material, life, its demands, which are real, you know, the problems of the body, the sense attractions that are there, that they completely cover their higher understanding being conditioned by material life. Now, I think the other issue is impersonalism. Srila Prabhupada came to preach to the Western world, and we say in his pranam mantras, Nirvishesha Shunyavadi, voidism and impersonalism. Now, if all these people are religious, the 90% of them, why do we say this is a land of impersonalism? Because impersonalism is very much steeped into the belief systems. People, even who say they believe in a personal God, they don't really understand what a personal God is and how to develop a relationship with God. Many religionists also believe in God and his kingdom, but think man's life is separate. He's up there, I'm down here. I may be a spirit soul, there is a God, but now I'm in a body, why not just fully embrace the experience, enjoy my senses? After all, God put all this stuff here, he created everything for our abundance, for us to enjoy, for us to be the masters of, right? This is a common idea. No, he didn't put everything for us to enjoy, he put everything here for us to give back to him, to serve him. These are all the elements that we can use for service. We take the material elements, we offer them to Krishna, and then they become spiritualized. We all know that. So they may equate the senses, the mind, the emotion as the self. They don't see a clear difference. Many people don't. In other words, they may think, yeah, I know I'm not my body. My body, these things happen, it grows, but you know, but they often think their mind or their intelligence is the real self. Whatever I'm thinking, that's real, that's me. However I feel about something, that's the real me. No, that's one aspect of your mind, of your mental conceptions. It's not you. Unless you're very advanced, then the mind and spirit become very close. Intelligence is next door to the soul. It becomes closer and closer as we become purified and make advancement. But usually it's not clear. And people aren't really clear as far as what is the real nature of the soul, our relationship with Krishna, and what our duty is. So often people, there was actually a philosophical movement in the 17th and 18th centuries called deism. I don't know if you've heard of this. But basically it's the analogy is given as like a clockmaker. God is like a clockmaker. He makes the clock, makes it very nicely, winds it all up, makes the natural laws, it's all put in place, lets it go. Turns it on, walks out the door, and does something else. They don't know what. In other words, he doesn't really have much part in our life. Yeah, God created everything, but here it is, and there's no real actual presence or part in our life. And the people like Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, kind of in the deism camp. They depend upon reason rather than revelation. They don't think God ever can reveal himself to anyone in this material world. He can't really be completely known. But they do have an ethical sense of being good to others, trying to do good, that kind of thing. Now, very few people would formally identify with titles, say, I'm a deist. People don't even know that word. But their activities are very much like that, aren't they? Like, God made everything, and now he's back in heaven, and I go about my life here in the material world. Now, sometimes impersonal, now, this is kind of an impersonal idea, really. In a sense, because you're not really seeing God as a person, as someone who is active, who has feeling relationships, who has variety, who has, you know, so many things, his pastimes, who's his beautiful personality. That's not there. None of that is there. Now, impersonalism is very formulated as a theory in India. We have Shankaracharya and, you know, philosophical systems that specifically teach impersonalism. In the West, it's more like sort of a non-spoken, practical life experience. You know, the people that can, you know, seem very impersonal. You know, you tell them that, you know, that there's a spirit soul in mountains, and they look at you like you're one of those, you know, crazy people, you know, some New Age nut or something, right? No, they don't understand that there's personality everywhere. Everything is a person. I mean, that's our philosophy. And Vaishnava philosophy fully articulates personalism. I'm not going to say that no other philosophy does. I'll just say Vaishnavism does. Vaishnavism personally understands, articulates, and puts into action what true personalism is. which is understanding God is a person, I am a person, we are all persons, we have a relationship with God. Now, is there material? There's also material. There is property, material energy. But we understand that energy is coming from God. You know, we can use that in His service. Nothing is seen as separate. Everything is alive. Everything is personal. We see the interactions. What's going on in the material world is an interaction between Prakriti, Jiva, and Ishvara, Krishna, right? I guess we could throw in time and karma, too, the five elements of Bhagavad Gita talks about. But this interaction, in other words, the spiritual energy is in everything. I was going to give a little mental example. I was thinking about this. Imagine you arrive, you're out hiking, probably in the West or something, and you come to a beautiful scene in the woods, beautiful woods, and there's this beautiful lake, and there's bright sunshine, and it's just so peaceful. And now you're by yourself, you say, no, I'm just alone, I'm enjoying nature. Okay. Are you ever alone? What is nature? In other words, there's so many misconceptions people have. I was thinking through, how would you see this from a devotional perspective? How would a Vaishnava look at that walks upon a scene and think? First of all, nature is not just an artistic backdrop for my visual enjoyment, right? In other words, as we go out there, oh yeah, this was somehow something just for me to enjoy. It's really pretty, you know, or it's not so nice, or whatever. What else is going on here? Living entities, the trees, everything, the grass, they are all spirit souls. They all have their own journey, evolving or devolving through the 8,400,000 species of life. And although it may seem very beautiful and serene, there's a hard struggle for existence. Anybody who's done any gardening knows that, you know, you have your vegetables, your flowers, and you have weeds growing up. All of a sudden, there's a struggle for existence. Are the weeds going to choke out the flower? That's the struggle for existence. All those roots under there are competing and fighting for who gets the nutrients. So that's going on. It's not just all peaceful and serene. But so we know Prakriti-sthani Parishati, that the living entities are struggling hard with material nature. Bhagavad Gita 15.7. Parishati, struggling with material nature. So that's one thing. Also, look at the natural elements. The water, the wind, the sun. All of these have controlling demigods. There's a person behind everything, right? There's a person behind the wind, Vayu. There's a person behind the water. The rain comes because of Indra. So there's that personality there also. Even the earth herself is this personified Bhumi. Mother Earth is there, right? The sun. Now, the sun isn't really just another demigod. The sun, as Surya Narayan, is actually an expansion of Krishna himself. I just learned this recently. I don't know why. I always thought that, you know, it was just another demigod. But Prabhupada says, purport 5.23.3, because it's only the predominating deity of the sun, Surya Narayan, is an incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, of course, that's one of the reasons why in the Gayatri Mantra we start out. You know, as far as the sun and the movements of the sun, because this is Narayan. And we can actually understand, I think, I should have looked this up, but isn't sunlight the reflection of the Brahma-jyoti into the material world?
Yes.
Right? Interesting. Confirmed. Okay. So, yeah. So, I mean, this is what a devotee might be thinking. Oh, look at the sun. This is Krishna. This is Krishna's Brahman effulgence coming into this material world through his representative, his incarnation, Surya Narayan. In other words, there's a lot of spiritual things going on in this little lake forest scene that we arrived upon. The modes of nature. How do the modes of nature affect everyone? Now, this scene is obviously more the mode of goodness, right? So I feel peaceful, you know. Now you can see though, there's the material reasons, the negative ions, things like that. But however it's arranged, there's different modes of nature. And so we might think, oh, this is more the mode of goodness. So you might think, oh, this is a very nice environment that is conducive for spiritual life. Maybe instead of just seeing how beautiful this is, I should sit down and chant a couple rounds, you know, or say my Gayatri, or whatever it might be. You know, that this is the way that we can sort of understand these things. And we understand the self. Who's enjoying? We understand that one is different from the body, the senses that are enjoying, the mind's feeling, thinking. All of this is going on. We don't deny it, we just recognize it. These are my senses acting. Nothing wrong with it, but we don't get caught up and think we are those senses, we are those mind, we are this body. We acknowledge it. We recognize that. And there's a higher plane of consciousness that's also there. And hopefully that's going on to some degree too. In this beautiful scene that we have, which is conducive to chanting Hare Krishna, where we become actually more and more connected with Krishna. And most important, the devotee understands and sees and feels, hopefully, or at least begins to, the presence of God, the presence of Krishna. First of all, Krishna is the super soul within oneself, within every living entity, within this grass, within these trees. There's the soul and there's the super soul. Like the two birds in the tree in the Swedish Upanishad. Yeah, the two birds and giant enjoying the tree. There's the us, trying to enjoy the material world. Krishna, that observer bird in the tree, waiting, Prabhupada says, waiting for us to turn to him. To stop picking at the fruit, trying to enjoy, and turn to him. And he accompanies us in every lifetime. This is Krishna's great kindness to the living entity. We go through all these horrible bodies and horrible lifetimes, and Krishna is there with us, patiently waiting. Someday, my devotee will turn to me and take up devotional service and give up all this trying to eat the fruit on the tree. So we see that. And we see that everything is coming from Krishna. Krishna describes things called vibhutis. What's a vibhuti? A vibhuti is like a power, right? It's an opulence, yes. There's even a chapter called Opulence of the Absolute, right? Chapter 10. And also in Srimad Bhagavatam, which is one of those last chapters in Canto 12, Chapter 11, is it? It talks about the opulence of the powers, the vibhutis of Krishna. So it's a couple of places in the Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, these things are discussed. And often they are things in the material world that represent Krishna or can be sort of show the power of Krishna, right? So a lot of these things Krishna says, you know, like, I am the source of this, I am the power of that, of all the fishes, I am the shark, you know. What are some of the other ones? What are some other ones?
I'm the face of water, I'm the pregnant flower, the sun and the moon.
What else? The immovable things and the Himalayas, yeah. Right. Beast is the lion, yeah.
And the mind among the senses.
Mind among the senses. So these are all the bhutis. These are powers and opulences of Krishna. So he uses material things in a sense to represent that so we can understand. But in another sense, it's also described, I think it's in the 12th canto in that chapter, but he also kind of puts his power into them too. I mean, you know, there's some empowerment that is there. We can see, you know, especially see Krishna in these places, in these ways. And we always remember from Bhagavad Gita 10:41, that all opulent, beautiful, and glorious creatures, creations, spring from but a spark of my splendor. So everything that we see in the material world, these beautiful scenes, all of anything we see in nature, wherever it might be, is a tiny spark of Krishna splendor, which if we were so fortunate to someday go to Goloka Vrindavan, we would see the full display of that splendor, where the real beauty is. You know, sometimes reading, you know, we read some of these descriptions, you know, Govardhan Hill and, you know, the waterfalls and all the beautiful flowers and everything, the birds. And, you know, it conveys this beautiful, and I think myself, at least, I can probably imagine a tiny fraction of it, of how incredibly wonderful it is. So that we also keep in mind. Yeah, there's some nice things here, and there's some terrible things here in this material world. But remember, the real opulence is there in the spiritual world with Krishna. So Krishna is never apart from the jiva, the super soul with us, Krishna is also described as our well-wisher and our best friend. Again, a person, we have a personal relationship with him. He's involved or should be involved in all aspects of our lives. I was trying to sometimes think about this, but it just kind of like, I'm going through life for Krishna. Krishna's here, what would Krishna want? You know, and I can really get in that mentality for a few seconds, you know, then I could become overcome, you know, with everything, and, you know. But every once in a while, we can try to think this way, get a little glimpse that Krishna's always with us. And we should recognize him. We don't take him out and pay lip service on Sundays or whatever. No. God's always there. Krishna's always there. And he's not here. It's just our order supplier. He's not here. Oh, this is nice. Thank you. Thank you for my daily bread. Probably, now, I'm going to be clear on this. Probably criticize that. He also said, 1,000 times better to at least thank God for your daily bread than to not to acknowledge God at all. Right? So that's good. First step is see everything is coming from Krishna. Then the greater advancement. And this is what we as Vaishnavas are trying to teach the world, following Srila Prabhupada on his behalf, that the real purpose of life is to serve Krishna, to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Through the 9 processes of devotional service, beginning with hearing and chanting, and especially through the holy name, by chanting his holy names, by glorifying him, this pleases him. So our goal in life is actually to please Krishna. It's as simple as that. We want to please Krishna, and through that pleasure, and of course we please Krishna through Radharani, right, through Lord Nityananda, through the Zikrasa, through Srila Prabhupada and our guru. By pleasing our spiritual master, we are pleasing Krishna. And there's a whole process. We don't just directly, I'm here buddies with Krishna. No, that's, you know, we don't want to jump, you know, jump over too many things there. So we want to please Krishna, we want to serve Krishna, and there in that way we become more and more purified, more and more advanced, so that we can understand Krishna, we can develop that loving relationship with him, and we can get out of this material world and go back home, back to Godhead. Or the real beauty and opulence. Krishna and Radharani can be experienced. Thank you very much. I'm sorry I took a little long here. I'll be curious to hear about it. Any questions, comments? Mukundapur. Sorry. Okay.
It's just in reference to the Gayatri mantras. So there's some very nice descriptions that the word that's used to indicate the sun in the Gayatri mantra is then qualified by the words that follow it. So it's saying that this is the superior category of Narayana. I don't want to say the mantra, but the word that indicates the sun represents Surya Narayana. But the word that immediately follows it says the superlative category of Narayana, which is Krishna. And then in the Padma Purana, it describes that the Vedamanta Gayatri, understanding the glory of the beauty of the service in Braj, meditated, that Brahma Gayatri took the form by the blessings of the Lord to become Kam Gayatri. That's why mostly in our line, up until Bhakti Sinan Saraswati Thakur, Brahma Gayatri was not given. He gave in order to show that those who are Vaishnavas, they're also equal to Brahmins. But in, like Mahaprabhu, so forth, they never received Brahma Gayatri and so forth. Just Gopal Mantra Kam Gayatri. Then the Kam Gayatri is mentioned in the 8th chapter of Chaitanya Charitamrita, Majjhalila chapter 8. And that explanation is the actual explanation of the Brahma Gayatri.
Do you remember what that verse was?
Yeah, it's Vrindavine Apakrita Navina Madhana Kama Bija Kama Gayatri Yanava Upasana.
Which means?
Means that the Apakrita Navina Madhana means Krishna as the beloved of Srimati Radhika. Right? The purpose, Kama Bija and Kama Gayatri Yanava Upasana, means to do the worship of that form of Krishna. So that verse is explaining what is Kama Gayatri. The Brahma Gayatri in its maturity, became Kama Gayatri.
Thank you. That was very interesting. But what was the? Do you remember the number of the verse?
I'll look it up.
Okay. Yeah. This. I'd like to see that. Frank Gavendram.
Such 24 and a half moon. Following verse of that, 24 and a half full moon, Krishna's face, Krishna's whole body is 24 and a half. I was thinking, Srila Prabhupada, one purport on second canto gives a very compassionate view about the world. He said, even people, those who are not inclined to directly appreciate God or accept God, but they do appreciate the nature. When the calamities takes place, they're like surprised. So as you read before that we accept transcendental is God beyond the nature, immense is God in the nature. As you mentioned all these vibhutis. So immense is God in the nature. So Prabhupada put very nicely, he says, those who actually appreciate the nature, they are actually appreciating Krishna's energy. Mm. Next life they will become a devotee of the demigods. And they will pursue further, and then they will become a follower of Lord Shiva, sun god, like that. And then they will become a Vishnu devotee. Life after, so yeah. Three to four lives.
Nice. I was also thinking of the scripture of Virata Rupa.
Right? Yes.
In other words, I should mention that, you know, how the mountains are Krishna's backbone, etc., etc. And Prabhupada says, and I think also Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur also says, that it's more or less, the Virata Rupa is more or less imaginary. It's not a real, you know, form of Krishna. Like, it's a way of conceptualizing, especially for neophytes. To, you know, it's a way of thinking about material elements and how Krishna can be in those. So I think it's appropriate for all of us neophytes to also see, when we see different elements, we can see how this is Krishna, this is his feet, this is his...
Correct.
Know, yeah, all of
I that. Think Prabhupada also mentioned there that it purifies our intelligence.
Purifies intelligence.
Yes. Yeah. Then we can grasp the actual form of the God.
Yeah.
A lot of time, even people come to temple, they cannot just sustain on that beautiful form of Radha Shamsundar. Once they leave the room, they kind of forgot.
You know, some people don't even see the deity for a while. I've heard devotees who said they were in the temple a couple weeks, so they realized, oh my gosh, they just thought there was some color up there. I don't know if they, you know, they finally realized, oh, there are persons up there. The deity.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's even more literal than what you're saying. Anyone else? Module 8138, which is a explanation of Kama Gayatri. Okay, 8138. I'll forget that. But, you know, because, like your Dhritarashtra, my memory is going.
You got it.
Okay.
You ready?
Oh.
You ready for this?
Stitchy Bimuni, I was waiting for you.
All right. Yeah, this is just a short one about the scientists. You know, I mean, we all say it, like the scientists believe this and that. But, you know, my uncle had a sign over the refrigerator at his summer lake cottage where the beer was, you know, the refreshments were. And it says, everybody has to believe in something, and I'll believe I have another drink, you know. So I guess the point there is, yeah, everybody believes something, but science itself, it's not about that belief. And it's oftentimes when people, like a Dawkins, get up there and say this and that, that's their beliefs about the natural world, yeah, as opposed to what the science may or may not be. Yeah. And whatever the science is at the present moment, it's all tentative. You know, it's like we have this much evidence that the community of scientists think is relevant to consider, and this is a hypothesis or an explanation that may best fit the evidence as far as the community of scientists are discussing it. And there may be a dominant consensus within the scientific community at some point, and it's always shifting, but there's always all kinds of discussion. Just like in any human community, in our community, there's maybe a GBC resolution, and that's the dominant, representing the dominant consensus, but there's still all kinds of discussion. So
really? Not everybody agrees?
I heard rumors. I might have read it at one of those.
Nobody, I know.
One of those websites that you're not supposed to read or something.
Okay.
So anyways, yeah, so I guess the point is, you know, there's science out there, and it's true, as you said, you know, within the modern culture context, there's this disproportionate amount of belief or faith invested in science as a discipline, but it, you know, what it actually is, as far as in sober moments, scientists will all agree that, you know, it's a tentative hypothesis, it's a discipline we're looking for.
Yeah, and there's a great variety with any field. This was generations ago. I mean, I think I remember my mother-in-law telling me about this, and it was from many years. It was a scientist named Loren Isley. I don't know if everybody knows even her, but he was well known 50 years ago. And he wrote a paper about what he's called Why a Scientist Should Believe in God.
They still write them.
Yeah.
I mean, this you know, like he was saying, this they take polls, and pretty consistently about 40% identify as Christians or of some sort,
yeah.
You know. There's, you know, amongst dominant. At any rate, it's this complication there. I guess just that we don't necessarily need to feel that science is something certain and they all believe this, and it's, you
right.
know, you know, it's a bunch of people and,
sure.
you know, whatever.
It's a good point.
Yeah.
Okay, student class. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.